What I want to do tonight, I've written an article of publishing First Things under this title, but I'm not going to give you that. I'm not going to rehearse that. Instead, I want to try to give a sense of my thinking about the crisis. I'm not sure it's a crisis, but nonetheless, the sort of political upheavals of our moment. We had a meeting with some friends last night and discussing whether we should call it a crisis or not, and there was an interesting debate about that. But there is a wide sense that the rules or the foundations or the what I will describe tonight as the underlying consensus in our public life is shifting, and the tectonic plates are grinding against each other in ways that were not the case half a dozen years ago. So my hope is tonight to give you some historical and then at the end some conceptual tools with which to think about the political agonies of the moment. We had our agonies a couple weeks ago, or last week, and then the week before in having to do with the Supreme Court appointment. And there was quite a display of I don't know what it seemed like over here, but the temperature has definitely been elevated. And I think our job should be, we have roles to play as partisans, and that's perfectly appropriate. But I do think we also need to think in this time and not just scream. And so my hope is, again, tonight to provide with some tools for doing some thinking. On the plane over, I was given a copy of the Financial Times. Though I don't regularly look at the paper, that particular paper, nowadays, there had been a time, 10 or so years ago, when I subscribed. In those years, I found the editorial pages useful. I regarded the Financial Times as a reliable voice of neoliberal realism. Less wonkish in tone than the sorts of things that one finds in the highbrow American press like the Wall Street Journal, and also less ideologically predictable. Martin Wolf, for example, was particularly good at dispelling the free market claptrap that prevented so many from facing up to the challenges posed by the 2008 financial crisis. So as I read the paper a few days ago on the plane, I was reminded why I never pick it up anymore. The regular writers whom I once read with interest now seem irrelevant. Edward Luce, who writes about America, writes about Donald Trump with all the bluster of the New Yorker magazine, as if it requires just one more column pointing out that Donald Trump is ignorant, corrupt, and evil to finally exorcise him from public life. Martin Wolf interprets what's happened over the last two or three years as an epidemic of what he calls derangement. Like many others, he seems not so much to be engaging the present as waiting for the nightmare to end and for reality to return. Even at this late date, nearly 2 years on, Philip Stevens, another FT writer, credits Trump's electoral victory to his ability to arouse ugly passions in what he describes as a base of angry, often elderly, white men. So it's a kind of wishful thinking that they're elderly, so they'll die soon and we can get back to really the way things are supposed to be. Now, perhaps I'm being unfair. I am sometimes unfair. And the Financial Times is less exhausted than the edition that I read. But the mentality I've outlined above is widespread. It's one of horror and disbelief rather than analysis and reflection. It is as if there can be no political debate about the ways in which globalization has dramatically transformed the national economies of the West. Nor, it seems, can this mentality imagine that we must make a fundamental decision about whether or not to trust the utopian promises made by multicultural ideologies. For example, that diversity will in fact be our strength, or that breaking down walls will promote harmony. It seems to me those are utopian promises. They're by no means empirical claims, but they're promises about the future. And we really do face a profound question as a society whether we're going to trust those promises or not. For Philip Stevens, populism is just ugly nativism and not a sign that today's voters are increasingly unhappy with the dominant regime, and perhaps for good reasons. For Wolf, efforts by politicians, he was thinking of Boris Johnson, to exploit the disorientation of elite opinion in order to gain power is nothing other than opportunism. He can't seem to entertain the idea that it reflects the rather healthy workings of a democratic polity in which leaders have strong incentives to satisfy the desires of voters. This mentality can't see the trends running counter to their assumptions as anything other than irrational spasms, the reptilian expressions of the tribal mind. Against what it presumed to be the mindless prejudice and misrule, their mentality sees itself nobly defending right reason. As Stevens puts it, quote, "The politics of identity has triumphed over common sense," end quote. So my purpose tonight is to unpack this mentality, which is quite widespread. And my argument will be that it's not common sense at all, but rather a calcified form of the consensus that emerged after World War II. This consensus, and I'm going to call it the post-war consensus, it's funny, you know, I look at these young faces in the room, and when you say post-war, they look at you and they say, now, which war was that? For someone my age, the post-war meant after World War II. So, clarification. So, this consensus, the post-war consensus, emphasizes motifs of openness, spontaneity, creativity, and innovation. It was self-consciously formulated in order to prevent the return of the strong gods to the West. And I'll define, you have to allow me the kind of poetic conceit of strong gods, but I will define it at the end of the, by the end of the talk. I'll give a definition of what of who the strong gods are. To prevent the return of the strong gods to the West, and these strong gods were thought to be the sources of fascism, nationalist-inspired wars, and totalitarianism. And this post-war consensus explains why notions such as open trade, open borders, and open minds resonate so positively. These notions enjoy the moral prestige of anti-fascism. It also explains why dissent from this consensus is shamed rather than analyzed and assessed. Because failures to affirm openness are necessarily treated by the post-war consensus as tacit endorsements of gulags and concentration camps. I think it was here a couple summers ago, I was in a meeting, and it was a paper on how to deal with the immigration crisis. And I think it was Rocco Battaglione, who was just a fine mind, outstanding fellow. But he gave an argument that within the current consensus, European consensus, a solution could be found. And then we had an AfD politician responding who argued that it couldn't be. And I tell you, particularly when it got to Auschwitz, I think within two exchanges in their debate. It's really amazing how quickly we get to Auschwitz. And I'll make a further case then that this consensus has become dysfunctional. So I want to make the case that the consensus explains the prevailing mentality today. And then secondly, that this mentality has become dysfunctional. It prevents us from addressing the challenges of the 21st century, which in the West resolve around, I will submit, a lack of solidarity and lack of shared loves rather than the dangers of over-consolidated national projects or too rigid borders or young minds closed upon dogmatic truths. I know the Q&A will say, isn't political correctness a kind of dogmatism, and I have maybe my overly clever explanation for why it's not. So, the post-war consensus. Even as World War I was raging, the philosopher of science Karl Popper worked to complete open society and its enemies, a two-volume diagnosis of the civilizational madness that led to the global conflict. By Popper's reckoning, civilization faces a choice. We can live in a tribal or closed society, characterized by deference to authority and the subordination of the interests of the individual to the needs of the whole. Or we can break free from this collectivist impulse, he uses the term collectivist or collectivism, this collectivist impulse, and build an open society, one that, in his language, sets free the critical powers of man. And as he argues, the future of the West depends upon choosing the latter, the open society. The imperative operating throughout the two volumes of Open Society and Its Enemies is bracingly simple. Never again. Never again shall we permit totalitarian governments to emerge. Never again shall we allow societies to gather themselves into a fever pitch of ideological fanaticism. In the service of this imperative, never again, we must banish the strong gods that presided over these closed societies, and we must create an open society organized around the free individual. Now, one of the strong gods are the nations of the West, and they must be overcome. We are tempted to imagine, thinks Popper, that our collective lives are in some sense sacred, giving the community a rightful claim upon our loyalty. Popper regards this as, he uses the term, magical thinking, and it's a form of what he describes as anti-humanitarian propaganda. By his reckoning, the individual is the only sacred reality. And good governance means allowing institutional technologists, that's his term, institutional technologists, to develop and refine the machinery of the state so that it serves the interests of everyone in an even-handed and impartial way. Now, Popper knows that there will always be what he calls state worshippers and other proponents of collectivism. And he thinks they must be dealt with firmly. Anyone who relishes his homeland and its history is, in his language, he calls them, this is his term, a racialist. And in this way, I think Popper anticipates today's rhetoric of anti-racism. But why should someone become a state worshipper, especially after witnessing the disastrous consequences of National Socialism? In The Open Society and Its Enemies, Popper proposes a psychological explanation that has been widely adopted. He hypothesizes that we feel a strain when we live in a society governed by democracy and oriented towards individualism. The collectivist proponent of the closed society promises something easier, a warmer, a more comforting existence. Social authority, like paternal authority, is attractive to those who are insecure and fearful. Intimidated, here I'm describing Popper's analysis, intimidated by personal responsibilities that freedom brings, we long for the security of obedience. We desire an escape from freedom, as the social psychologist Eric Fromm put it in a title of his influential explanation of the origins of National Socialism, published in 1941. The title of that volume, I think, in English is Escape from Freedom. Yeah, I think it was originally published in English, Escape from Freedom. The closed and tribal society is psychologically soothing and reassuring. It helps us avoid the tension of, as this is Popper's language, quote, an ever-widening field of personal decisions with its problems and responsibilities, end quote. So against this temptation, we must gird our loins, Popper warns us. We need to embrace our freedom with courage rather than deferring to authority out of cowardice. Only an open society can save us from the return of totalitarianism. Now, the main body of the Open Society and Its Enemies is devoted to an attack on the metaphysical tradition of the West in the person of Plato. Popper sees any form of transcendence as implicitly totalitarian. To claim that there is something higher than the individual sets up a supra personal authority, something above. Long before the invention of words such as logocentrism and heteronormativity, Popper cast strong truth claims as threats to freedom and midwives to the rebirth of totalitarianism. We need, by his reckoning, we need modesty with respect to truth if we're to develop an open society. It really is striking when I reread. I read Open Society and Its Enemies as a graduate student, and when I reread it, I was very struck by the resonances with postmodernism broadly. And in fact, in this larger project I'm working on, it kind of culminates with a discussion of Gianni Vattimo, who I think is an intellectual journalist. I'm an intellectual journalist. He's an actual intellectual journalist. In the sense that he, I think, is a very astute and poetic representative of a of the post-war consensus and its kind of final stages around the, at the turn of the last century. So, although his framework is different, Popper anticipated John Rawls, whose political philosophy became very influential toward the end of the 20th century. Rawls extends the liberal tradition of keeping theological claims at arm's length from politics by arguing that we should not govern society in accord with metaphysical notions of any sort, what he calls them comprehensive doctrines in his vocabulary. This differs from Popper, who rejects metaphysical claims because they are not open to empirical falsification. But the overall stance is largely the same. According to Popper, the strong truths are strong gods, and as a consequence, they pose an intrinsic threat to liberal norms. They are enemies of an open society. In other words, we need public reason, as Rawls would put it. This means an anti-metaphysical and often procedural approach in which truth claims are limited to what can be empirically assessed by those who have command of the relevant data. In Popper's terms, we don't need politics in the classical sense, because politics in the classical sense involves arguments about how we should live. And these arguments inevitably outrun the domain of what can be subjected to social scientific analysis. Rather, for Popper, our politics needs to, the image I have is go small. We need to go small in our politics. It should be scientific, not metaphysical. And, quote, a social technology is needed whose results can be tested by social engineering, end quote. In this respect, Popper anticipates the reduction of public life to wonkish debates about how to allocate utilities. Now, this politics of the open society seems to beg an important question. What is freedom for? Historically, the West has appealed to metaphysics and to religion for answers to that question. Popper is aware of the question, and he gives an existentialist answer of the sort that Albert Camus would make popular in the 1950s. We must accept the strain of freedom, courageously embracing the existential tension that comes from knowing that we must decide for ourselves the ends our freedom are to serve. In other words, it's up to us to define the truths that make our lives worth living. As Popper emphasizes, this is, quote, although history has no meaning, we can give it meaning. It's in italics, and you want to emphasize this in Open Society and Its Enemies. So the very truth about reality itself depends upon us. Quote, facts as such have no meaning. They gain it only through our decisions, end quote. Now, Nietzsche thought it would take superhuman strength for someone to self-consciously give himself his own truth. Only a strong god, an ubermensch, can mint truths rather than discern and obey them. Now, this is certainly not what Popper wants. His object is modesty, not assertion. So he hedges, using the word meaning instead of truth. And this move characterizes the post-war era, which has consistently adopted a deflationary policy when it comes to truth. Following Max Weber, Popper insists that value-free facts alone constitute the domain of truth. Whatever we make of them amounts to meaning. In this way, Popper weakens the strong God of truth, keeping it narrowly scientific. When we need a guiding and commanding language with which to govern our lives and set standards for society, we appeal to meaning. And this is a weakening move, this substitution of meaning for truth. Now, like so much else in the Open Society and its enemies, the shift from truth to meaning is required by the Manichaean political choice that the post-war era felt was being pressed upon the West, either an open society or the horrors of Auschwitz. And again, it's amazing how the 1930s are, in as we have these political debates, or not debates at all, but rather political collisions, it's amazing how the language of the 1930s is right there immediately. And it's a sign of how powerful this consensus is, and I think it should alert us to its historical roots and invite this kind of reflection. In the face of such a choice, either the Open Society or Auschwitz, the search for transcendence becomes a malign endeavor rather than reflecting a healthy human desire. By Popper's account, we are tempted to elevate truths and pledge our troth to them, setting us upon the road back to totalitarianism. The only way out of this trap is to adopt the double pattern of weakening, going small with value-free, fact-based truth, and satisfying the larger needs of the human heart with an ambiguous rhetoric of meaning. Now, the two volumes of The Open Society and Enemies that I have in my private library at home are a first edition published in Great Britain in 1945 as American soldiers were liberating the Buchenwald concentration camp and Berlin was in ruins. The signature in the front shows it was bought by James B. Conant, then president of Harvard University and one of the top civilian leaders of the Manhattan Project that produced the atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. His discreet markings in the margins indicate that he read the book with interest, especially the parts where Popper expounds his conviction that an attitude of reasonableness, as he says, must serve as the basis of a democratic society. Now, Conant was no moral relativist, nor was Karl Popper. They trusted in science and believed in the intellectual virtues of impartiality, honest debate, and close attention to empirical data. And although the Axis powers had been overcome, the future of the West remained uncertain in their minds. And they were not alone. The Soviet Union's aggressive stance in the immediate aftermath of the war dramatized the totalitarian temptation. Concerns about the dangers of a closed society were widespread among the democratic leaders in the post-war West. Their counsel was consistently one of vigilance. The virtues of the open society must be championed. And they believed that the West needed a thoroughgoing cultural reconstruction to forestall the return of the strong gods. I mean, I think it's important to go back and read this literature from the late 1940s, how consistently the consensus is that we need a deep cultural reconstruction. Never again. Whether directly inspired by Popper or not, the establishment American liberalism of the sort that Conant represented moved in the direction of empiricism combined with meaning-oriented rhetoric that inevitably punted when it came to metaphysical foundations. As George Marsden explains in his account of post-war politics in the United States, under the title of The Twilight of American Liberalism, the 1950s and the Crisis of Liberal Belief, an older consensus about natural rights gave way to a liberal consensus about the importance of consensus. And you know, meaning lends itself to establishment-dominated politics. because meaning is more socially dependent than truth, interestingly. So it's a paradox about Popper's. The aversion to meaning instead of truth actually kind of weakens the individual vis-a-vis whatever the public realm is. Meaning is a social, although it's often cast existentially as a personal category. But I think sociologically, I think it's obvious that it's a social category. Belief in a new post-ideological way of life was widespread after World War II in the United States. Social scientists and psychologists such as Abraham Maslow, Karen Horney, Rollo May, and many others, they may not have read Popper. Nevertheless, the ideas were in the air, and they developed his themes. They were concerned about the closed society of bourgeois sensibilities, which were thought to be too constricting. The middle-class milieu of the 1950s was consistently glossed as conventionality, the psychosocial analog to Popper's closed society. This was deemed an impediment to personal growth and authenticity. And so to counter these consolidating closed society pressures, influential psychologists of the era articulated therapeutic versions of the open society. At the same time, again following Popper, not explicitly, but rather as part of a larger and increasingly powerful post-war consensus, the new pop psychology of personal growth and self-realization remains scrupulously anti-metaphysical. The therapeutic search for meaning supplanted the classical search for truth. This search was framed with platitudes, all playing upon the theme of openness in one key or another. We're to grow towards greater meaning, or self-actualization, or autonomy, or a fuller and more expressive way of being, as Hillary Clinton put it in her commencement speech as a graduating senior at Wellesley at the end of the 1960s. It's really quite striking to read this literature, how the motifs of openness are always, you know, you're ringing the changes on openness. I don't have time to discuss it, but one of the influential works in the late 40s was a social scientific study of the authoritarian personality. It's horrible social science, but it's an ideologically in perfect sync with Popper. And I think reflected this really deep consensus that was emerging already in 1945. Never again. We have to drive out the strong gods, and we have to have an anti-metaphysical culture. At first glance, it seems obvious that a politics without principles and growth without determinate ends must, by definition, be open and capacious. For there would be no basis on which to exclude any particular idea or initiative. Of course, post-war liberals complimented themselves for having precisely those qualities of openness and capaciousness. And some indeed manifested Popper's hope for openness. But in the main, consensus liberalism since 1945 has punished dissent. It consistently berated strong truth claims as signaling a return of illiberalism, fascism, and other evils of the 1945 situation, the pre-1945 situation. It's a mode of argument that's very much with us today. I mean, if you look at reviews of William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale, he's accused of fascism, racism, the specter of the Ku Klux Klan. Walter Lippmann, one of the founding editors of the New Republic, one of the great liberal journals of 20th century American public life, when he wrote a book calling for metaphysical foundations for liberalism, he was attacked as a crypto-fascist and giving aid and comfort to the McCarthyites, McCarthyism. So already in the 50s, we had this rhetoric of denunciation, the reductio ad Hitlerum. The heightened rhetoric of anti-fascism, as I said, continues to be prominent today. And this is not surprising. Popper makes clear, as Popper makes clear, pragmatism in politics, the end of strong truth claims in public life, produces a paradoxically strong political and cultural set of imperatives. And Nietzsche recognized this, which is why he said it would require heroic will to power in order to achieve this, not liberal tolerance. The open society requires denying principled political arguments and policies. Championing authenticity in personal life requires rejecting the authority of traditional moral norms. You can't get young people to embrace anti-authoritarianism without deconstructing authority. We already have Popper's analysis, the strain of freedom. People want to escape from freedom. So if you want a society that's genuinely open, you have to work against human nature. And to do that, well, you have to use very strong tools. So there's a paradoxical quality to this open society. It has its own kind of coercive logic to it, which political correctness, you know, we experience this today. So thus, as the post-war consensus gained strength, it imposed a negative piety. So education now is education into a negative piety. It's a very vigorous, rigorous socialization process. It teaches us that we have a duty to the future of society and to the well-being of our children to banish the traditionalists, for they are loyal to the strong gods, which is the underlying cause of fascism. I mean, given this consensus and how powerful it became so quickly, I think we can see that as the students rioting in Paris insisted in 1968, it is forbidden to forbid. I mean, that's a kind of a strong statement in favor of weakness, so to speak, a weakening. But I think we can see that far from being revolutionaries, they had learned their lessons well. Now, as Popper was working on open society and its enemies, Friedrich Hayek was writing his own wartime book, The Road to Serfdom. It, too, sought to guide the reconstruction of Europe after the defeat of fascism and Nazism. Published the same year as The Open Society and Its Enemies, 1945, Hayek's analysis has a different feel. As an economist, Hayek's focus is narrower. During the war, England's economy, and the United States as well, was transformed into a command and control system of production quotas, rationing, price controls, and wage boards, among many other controls. Hayek was horrified to learn that many intellectual leaders in England envisioned a continuation of these methods of economic planning once the war ended, redirecting them towards peacetime objectives. And he wrote The Road to Serfdom to warn against the dire totalitarian consequences of this course of action. Now, Hayek frames the future in terms of a choice between individualism and collectivism. He uses the same vocabulary as Popper does in many regards. The collectivist, by his way of thinking, imagines society governed by powerful forces that weld individuals into a single we. We, the first person plural. This pattern of thinking about social and political life, argues Hayek, characterized Hitler's race-based fascism, as well as communism's class-based totalitarianism. Now, Hayek is not as precise as Popper, but he intuits that resisting collectivism requires an anti-metaphysical stance. The first principle of individualism is individual liberty, which means we must resist anything that compels our choices, including solid and significant moral truths. The essence of individualism is the freedom every individual enjoys to be, this is as Popper puts it, I mean, as Hayek puts it, the ultimate judge of his ends. So, in other words, I must have the liberty to decide what is good and bad for me. Now, Hayek equivocates, right? What's good and bad for me in terms of my maximizing my utility? Sometimes he wants to cordon off and say that sort of moral and the other, these other truths, but they certainly are not allowed to enter into public life. We want to limit public life to the kinds of goods that people are free to decide if they like them or not. In short, Hayek, like Popper, treats metaphysical realities, the social bond, moral truth, as threats to the individual. He, too, advocates a severe intellectual asceticism. Only the individual is real, as he states in The Road to Serfdom. Notions such as the general interest and common good are at best placeholder terms for aggregations of individual interests and welfare. Politics should be concerned about maximizing individual freedom and utility, not promoting a common way of life or a moral community. Although both Popper and Hayek champion the individual against the collective, they do not agree across the board, any more than the center-left, center-right expressions of the post-war consensus have agreed on social policies over the last 70 years. Popper speaks warmly of social technologists who adopt an empirical approach to governance, which, Hayek, by contrast, offers a thoroughgoing criticism of the technocratic approach. Against rational planning, he champions the spontaneous forces of society. That's his language, the spontaneous forces of society, which are paradigmatically found in the free market. And this is why he became a hero for post-war conservatives in the United States. The bulk of The Road to Serfdom argues for the free market against socialism. Our political goal, insists Hayek, should be to expand the range of individual freedom, which means that we should seek to bring as much of civic life as possible under the dominion of spontaneous market-organized relations. The more the market rules, and I think this is Hayekian, he's a subtle thinker, you know, the Constitution of Liberty, but I think certainly The Road to Serfdom, the more the market rules, the safer we will be from totalitarian domination. For in his theory, the market mechanism is intrinsically anti-totalitarian. Now, in the post-war era, I submit, the main thrusts that we find in Popper and Hayek have become ascendant. The post-war center-left is home to the cultural project of openness, the anti-metaphysical stance, transgressions that break down the authority of social norms that promote inclusion, and the politics of diversity and multiculturalism. This explains why post-war liberals could so easily absorb the seemingly revolutionary challenges of 1968 and subsequent developments. That always begs for explanation. Why is it that Oxford is able to swallow the revolutionary rhetoric of so many of the sort of Foucauldian, Derridean, and onward? And partly because it chimes with this larger theme of openness. And the general sense that maybe they go too far, but by and large, it's good for society to be loosened up. It does not take much effort to fit these folks into Popper's framework. By his way of thinking, explosions of traditional norms become expressions of anti-fascism. And I think today, transgenderism enjoys moral prestige for precisely that reason. It's an anti-fascist gesture. So one can say that the center-left in the post-war era has become the party of cultural deregulation. Meanwhile, the center-right has been home to the promise of free markets as a source of social order that does not rely on normative authorities, only on those necessary to maintain stable market mechanisms. The European center-right laid the foundations for open markets that evolved to the European Union. And in America and in Europe, center-right parties supported global economic liberalization after the fall of the Soviet Union. Although terms such as individualism and collectivism that motor the analysis of The Road to Serfdom have fallen by the wayside over the decades, the basic thrust of Hayek's approach animates the right-leaning political post-war consensus to this day. Freedom, peace, and prosperity are best served by expanding the market's function as the foundational source of social order. I think that's the Hayekian promise. The Hayekian promise is that we'll get freedom, peace, and prosperity the more the market functions as a foundational source of social order. because it doesn't require any strong gods. And just as for Popper, the more we deconstruct social authority, the more we will achieve the ideal of the open society. So more and more, these two parties, the center-right and the center-left, have merged, as we know. And today we see a deregulatory spirit predominating both in cultural and in economic life. That goes under the name of neoliberalism. Okay, that's my kind of historical, that's a little bit of a whirlwind tour. I mean, I'm working on a book, and I developed this in much more detail with other intellectual figures. But it's my historical thesis that Martin Wolf, Philip Stevens, Edward Luce, and many others are socialized into the post-war consensus, which always defaults towards openness and spontaneity, and that any counter move or any objection to the world created by this consensus is always described as fascist, or in some kind of return of totalitarianism. We're kind of stuck in this intellectual social framework. So now to the kind of try to think about where do we go from here. That's always the hard part, right? Notice how I've spent a lot of time getting to here, so I don't have to say too much about where we go from here. We face a crisis in the West. It is depicted in different ways. The Financial Times crowd treats it as an illusion, a consequence of momentary derangements. Others warn that economic changes over the last few decades have broken the social contract between labor and capital that was established after World War II. I think Thomas Piketty comes to mind. More and more people, and then another explanation, more and more people are waking up to the fact that unrestrained immigration is a source of social dislocation and mistreatment, of a mistrust of elites. I think Christopher Caldwell, Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, and then Douglas Murray, The Strange Death of Europe, are effective descriptions of that particular account of the crisis. Still others identify a spiritual malaise, one rooted in secularization and manifest in the very low birth rates in Europe, reflecting a mentality that desires no future beyond the worldly self. Now, there's something to be said for all of these explanations, even the one that treats the crisis as illusory. For it is my conviction that our troubles stem from the superannuated post-war consensus. It's the nature of human life to face problems, immigration, globalization, economic globalization, deindustrialization. It's the nature, spiritual malaise. It's our fate to have to always face these things. And so it's my thesis that the crisis comes from the fact that we're facing these things disarmed, morally, intellectually disarmed. The imperative of openness rather than solidarity and the preference for spontaneous order rather than authoritative order has led to an anti-politics, I would submit. We live in a culture of anti-politics, dominant culture of anti-politics, that deprives us of the concepts we need to meet the challenges facing the West in the 21st century. Post-war consensus intellectually disarms us to actually even think about the problems. Here's an off-the-cuff list of those challenges. Should there be limits to globalization? And if so, set by whom and toward what end? Relatedly, can we make the global economy work for middling folks in the West? Another challenge, what is the future of the Pax Americana? And then the mother of them all, how should we respond to mass immigration? All of these challenges revolve around another question, what is the role of the nation in the 21st century? Now, these questions require us to ask much deeper questions than we have been trained to ask, ones that touch upon the essence of public life. Who are we? What is the common love we share? What communal loyalties justly demand sacrifice? And who among us belongs to the we? Popper and Hayek rule out these questions. In an open society, they must not be asked, much less answered, for they lead to fascism, or so we are told. And this is why we have the prevalence of the reductio ad Hitlerum these days. For the free market libertarian, the miracle of spontaneous order means that we need not ask or answer the question of the we. Free trade will knit the world together. Something like Paul Samuelson's price theory of price factor equalization shows that the market will eventually sort out the disequilibria brought by globalization. If we're just patient, the market will solve our political problems, which means we don't really need politics at all. And Popper and Hayek understood, in every political culture, the we touches upon sacred things. We're by nature social animals, true, but the particularity of the we is a gift. Patrimony comes unbidden. And I was created in the image and likeness of God, but I was not created a Reno. And the same holds for the solidarity we feel as peoples. We're not created American or English or Polish. And of course, this is also true of the religious we, which comes from a divine source. The agony of the West in the 21st century rests in the crisis of the we. At every turn, we find solidarity in marriage, nation, and faith increasingly inaccessible. These forms of the we are disintegrating in the 21st century. And at the very same time, we've inherited a political, cultural consensus that describes even to articulate what we have lost as crypto-fascist, to say nothing of efforts to try to renew these forms of solidarity. To even articulate in public what we've lost evokes denunciation, it seems to me. I mean, in marriage, it's a patriarchal, whatever, heteronormative, la, 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 la. We can't even get in public to say, well, wait a minute, we suffer from a crisis of the possibility of the continuity of families is at risk in our societies. Okay, now my definition of a strong God. The strong gods are whatever evoke love. Love of the divine, love of truth, love of country, love of family. So strong gods are what evoke love. The post-war consensus is fearful of love, which it rightly recognizes as something that can lead to destructive devotions. Our consensus in favor of openness seeks to prevent these dangers by depriving us of love's objects, which means banishing the strong gods. It does so by critiquing, deconstructing, and deflating them. It has succeeded for the most part, and in doing so has brought calm to the West. Like, it has succeeded in many of its goals, and it has succeeded in bringing calm. But this project of peace without love cannot go on much longer. Man was not created to be alone, as we learn in the second chapter of Genesis. We do not desire calm, not even when satiated by countless pleasures and a great deal of wealth. We yearn to join ourselves to others, not just in matrimony, but in social and religious bonds as well. The we arises out of love, a ferocious power that seeks to rest in something greater, to rest in loyalty to strong gods who are worthy of love's devotion and sacrifice. I am more and more convinced that our political upheavals reflect a post-war consensus and its reflect a crisis of the post-war consensus and its fixation on preventing the return of the strong gods. This consensus and the elite devoted to it deprive our fellow citizens of objects worthy of their love. Insofar as our present leaders insist upon the post-war consensus, they will bring woe, not peace. For absent opportunities for true and ennobling loves, of which patriotic ardor is surely one, people will default to demagogues and charlatans who offer them false and debasing loves. Our job, therefore, is to restore political life by developing a language of love, a vision of the we, a vision that befits our dignity and appeals to our reason as well as to our hearts. We need to become patrons of the strong gods, the ones who come from above and animate our best traditions. For I submit that only that kind of leadership will forestall the return of the dark gods who rise from below. Thank you.
I was wondering what you would make of gate wielders in the Netherlands. The way, obviously, it can be considered quite illiberal, the way he is very vehemently opposed to Islam, but then the way he does this by portraying Islam as illiberal and totalitarian. I was wondering what you would make of that, maybe in comparison to other countries in which opposition to Islam is not portrayed in these terms of kind of the post-war consensus and liberalism, like you said.
Great character, Guillermo.
Similar. Political Islam, BJP, the Kud, the rise of strong religious identity in the modern world, and how that has posed huge difficulties for the Western notions. And I think of Corbyn, for example, and the huge difficulties they have in terms of what is politically correct to be in favour of or against because of identity politics in relation to love identity in Islam, in Judaism, and in Hinduism.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to when Popper said we should marginalize people who are take pride in their tradition or nations, and we should marginalize people who affirm strong truths. Is he talking about, is he meaning to universalize that, or did he mean that only for the West? Because it seems to me that the way it's played out is that for Muslims or even Islamists who have very strong convictions, the culture celebrates them sometimes, and if, as in citizens of other countries, if Nigerians or Japanese or Turks are proud of their history or culture or ethnicity, then they're also celebrated. So it just seems that it's not universal. I'm just wondering if when Popper developed it, did he mean it as universal?
Mm. All right, that's the political religion. I'll go first because I think your question and Geert Wilders, they actually go together. We're made for love, so and that has a social form and not just a personal form. So it has obviously a religious form as well, and so these nationalist, religious nationalist or nationalist impulses strike mm-hmm. me as perennial, and I don't see them as necessarily bad in them intrinsically, but maybe this is to get to Wilders. Our tradition is liberal, right? So it strikes me as that we and I think this is what Wilders is in a kind of he's a weakener. His tradition is weakening, right? And he's worried that he wants to protect the world with no strong gods. So it's a paradoxical kind of loyalty. To intense loyalty to this post-war opening it's very difficult to to see how that makes sense and that's your point that it would seem to be more consistent to accept a certain kind of self-annihilation in the face of the other. That would be a kind of spirituality of the open society, so to speak. But, But I think, you know, so the fact that we look at Modi and what's going on in India with foreboding is, I think, justifiable. I mean, partly because it's not our tradition. Our tradition, as I said, Rawls extends the liberal tradition of keeping theological claims at arm's length from political governance. I happen to like that tradition. I think that's a good move. But what happens after World War II is that becomes intensified and absolutized in a way that's, I think, unworkable over the long haul. But I'm not sure exactly how, you know, the Indian culture, you know, if it faces disillusion as a culture, a billion people with no kind of cultural orientation or sense of home, that would be far more destabilizing than a truculent, difficult nationalist leader.
Thank you so much. On the question of needing to move to a world where we have more sort of substantive we's to belong to, in the field of social ontology and philosophy, one of the biggest problems with defining the word we is that we always need someone to recognize that there's such a thing as a we. And in this kind of in the context that you helpfully given. I just wonder in your view of how we move into a world where there are sort of more substantive sort of bonds that are grounded in a sense of we, who's going to do that recognizing? Is it the state or groups? And how do we respond to a world where, you know, in with globalized communication, there are lots of voices saying you can't have that we, you know, you can't be a we in that way. And so I wonder, how exactly are these kind of forms of we going to exist?
The we always has a political expression. So it's just impossible for there to be a we without. It doesn't have to control the power of government, but there's a communal form to the we. And so it's natural that the we would find expression in political symbolism and ritual. And the recognition is mutual, it seems to me. You know, I have this argument with people about how can there be a 330 million we in the United States? My answer is just go there. I mean, aren't we recognizable when we show up? We Americans? I think we are. And it's not just that, I mean, and that we is very transformative of immigrants. It's a very powerful one, and it takes the children away from the parents. So we have a very powerful we in the United States, it seems to me. But we re-describe it. And that's why we're the dangerous nation in this post-war consensus, because we redescribe our we as openness, right? That's our we, and there's some truth to that, right? And so on, but I do feel like, right, the prohibitions against these modes of recognition are becoming toxic. And I think identity politics is a desire for a we, in a vacuum, in the absence of them. But they're the dark gods that come from below, because if you want blood, that's blood and soil. Is identity politics is blood and soil. There's no narrative, and I think the healthy we, social political we, is a story. It's something that can be told. You know, it's a history, it's a practice, it's an activity that admits of self-criticism and also development and extension. Whereas, you know, race and these sorts of things are blood things. They're not They're not face-to-face, because you know, the we, at its healthy form, emerges out of the history of people that are engaging each other face-to-face as persons.
Can we touch on the issue of Auschwitz, that the Western democracies realize what Auschwitz meant, what it, so to speak, stood for, how to prevent it happening again, how to prevent the developments that led to it taking place again. Why did it not take on board earlier on Solovkin, the first concentration camp that Lenin and Dzerzhinsky set up immediately after they seized power? Because already National Socialism was a reaction against the Bolshevik seizure of power. And so the West seems to be focusing on such issues as Auschwitz and how to prevent that. Why did it not take on board, or sufficiently on board, Solovki, the Solovetsky concentration camp?
I think if you look at the best of the post-war literature, it joins the Soviet Union and Nazism together. I mean, Hannah Arendt's very influential Origins of Totalitarianism, written in the late 40s, is very clear about the fact that they both function. They have different dimensions, but they both have this totalitarian character. So I do think that for the post-war West, there was not an exception made. I mean, maybe just the nature of our politics. You know, liberalism is a modern progressive. It's a form of modern progressivism. So it always has a kind of soft spot for communism as a also an Enlightenment kind of progressivism. I think John Gray has written very perceptively that the fall of the Soviet Union really it's a harbinger of the end of kind of the Enlightenment project in the West, because it was the most ambitious effort. It failed catastrophically. And so part of my view is that I think liberal theory is an Enlightenment project, but that our societies are liberal by tradition, not by theory. And so therefore we can sustain the best of that era if we restore a vocabulary to talk about who we are, and a willingness to speak about who we are. I think that's the most charitable way to think about Wilders. He's trying to have a way to talk about what it means to be Dutch. And for that, it means being, you know, affirming homosexuality, you know, is what it means to be Dutch. I think I'm not sure that works, right? Because that's an emblem of openness. So if you're open to that, why aren't you open to immigrants, you know, or Muslims?
So we take just another two questions, unfortunately. Yeah?
My question is related in a way to the third questioner's point. Would you say that for all its faults, the problem with globalization has sometimes been rather that it has been misapplied? Or it has been applied inconsistently. That's why you get all these, you know, paradoxical situations where people in the West want the West to be open, multicultural, diverse, but they want, for example, the Eastern spiritualities and nations that they experience to remain in its exotic purity. People talk about the Davos man, where they think that although, you know, the global citizens are really truly global, globe-trotting, literally true, but culturally they're kind of all the same. They want to globalize only on the terms of the open West. Whereas it seems to me a true kind of globalization, where we conceive of the whole world as a kind of we, to use your language.
I don't think it's possible.
Well, but if you did that, you would recognize that within that global we, there, you know, people do naturally want to have smaller kinds of we's.
Right, because
it's still continuous.
They recognize that there is no global we. I mean, I don't think there's a global common good, for instance. I mean, it could be that environmental things, climate change and so forth, begins to touch on that, although there's a global aggregate of utility, but I don't think there's a global common good. Because a common good is not the same as an aggregate of utility. I mean, common goods are things that we can only have if we have them in common. And if we part them out, they don't exist anymore. And so if I'm Lithuanian, one of the common goods is the survival of my language. And that can only survive under the we as a common good. It can't survive as... We can't take the good of that language and then parcel it out and say everybody gets a certain percent of that good. Or it's like a park, you know, you can't take a public park and then reallocate it as a private good and preserve the good of the park. So I have a hard time conceptualizing a global common good. And that's why people intuitively sense that whatever we should rightly try to seek, you know, a global order, and we should definitely, it could be that peace, which is a negative peace of absence of conflict, is a kind of global common good. But people recognize that whatever we want to achieve globally, it isn't going to answer a human need to share a common love politically. And so in that sense, what's going on in other countries as there's a resistance in the EU, obviously Great Britain is an example, but Poland, Hungary, those strike me as healthy impulses. Even if in a particular, it's a kind of poorly framed way, or the policies are bad, the impulse strikes me as healthy. Fellow in the background, one more.
Yeah. I'm a little puzzled. It seems like you've got a very, very narrow range of means that you accept. You probably would accept religious we, particularly Catholic we, but you also accept nationalism of some sort. But one could argue that's a romantic construction of the 19th century. And within the liberal response, secular nationalism, you've said that lots of things are that people identify as we's are dark from the soil, and you don't really want to accept those. If I rule out nationalism, what am I left with? Maybe that's enough for you, but I'm afraid that I'm seeing a zero in terms of we's that are acceptable to you outside of the religious.
No, you got, there's the domestic, the societal, and then the religious. Those are, I think, are the three, at least in the Catholic tradition, they're seen as the three necessary societies. There's a political, we call it polity, family polity, and then church. Like synagogue or mosque, I mean, I think that this kind of thinking isn't restricted to a particular theological construction of that religious we. But the polity can be local. A healthy polity has many layers to it, I think. But I think people can say, well, the modern nation state is a modern construction. Okay, right, fine. How are we really convinced we've left that behind? We have to live politically in the world in which we're cast. And it seems that we're cast into a world where ordinary people look to the nation state for a great deal of their sense of who they are, you know, and to what that to which they belong. Now, it may not be as acute here, but in the United States, you know, most people have very ordinary lives. And the most noble thing that they have is to be an American citizen. And one reason that Trump succeeded is he told them that that was a noble thing. And you take that away from people, and they're left with their drug-addicted son, their crappy job, their two divorces. And you take that away from them, and you think you're going to win an election? Forget about it. In fact, you think you can run a healthy society without that? I think forget about it. So I think we just need to, you know, again, I'm a liberal in the classical, in a traditional sense, and so I fear the concentration of identity in the national form. But it's clearly the case that people desire that, and that desire, I believe, should be met, and it should be leavened by encouraging many layers of political life. And so people sense they're from a place, they're from a city, they're from a region, they're from a family, they're from a city, they're from a region, they're from a country, and they have a religious community that transcends nation and gives them some some sense of what it means to be a member of the human race.
Thank you. So can you join me again saying thank you?